Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedy is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or ANJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course, so it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedies in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America, a Every time you visit the homepage of yourremedyisinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy is in the Law. And Your Remedy is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you what are your hot points interested in. This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights. Anything that you can think of. But if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of what you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedom's Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, and you're just new to Your Remedies in the Law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to Your Remedies in the Law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you'll get some one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedom's Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, so winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if the remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at your remedies in the law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if we can disclose properly and then answer properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Martin, we thank you for the time that you took to make this wonderful disclaimer. Let's see if we got standby. So let's start off with something that is near and dear to all of our hearts. Let's talk about the Zone Improvement Plan before we bring on PJ. Zone Improvement Plan. You got an idea what that is? We call it the ZIP code, ZIP, Zone Improvement Plan. Use of the Zone Improvement Plan. Use of your ZIP code is voluntary. Reference Domestic Mail Services Regulation Section 122.32. You should also know that the Postal Service cannot discriminate against the non-use of the ZIP code. Reference Postal Reorganization Act, Section 403. It is public law found at 91/375. Although the ZIP code was created back in 1963, the Buck Act of 1940 gave it its basis in law. The federal government utilizes the ZIP code to prove that you, quote, reside, end quote, in one of the federal districts of the District of Columbia, as opposed to living in one of the, quote, states which are united by and under the Constitution, end quote. This is why the IRS and other agencies, other government agencies, whether state or federal, which is the same thing anyways, maybe PJ will touch on that a little bit later, these state agencies and federal agencies require a zip code when they assert jurisdiction by sending you a letter. They claim that this speeds up the mail. However, this is a sly and subtle trick. It's also prima facie evidence that you are a subject of the Congress. and are a citizen of the District of Columbia who is resident in one of the several states. You know me with my court cases. U.S. versus Valentine's, 288 F. Sup. 957, quote, the only absolute and unqualified right of a United States citizen is residence within the territorial boundaries of the United States, end quote. Wheeling Steel Corporation versus Fox, quote, therefore, the U.S. citizen, open bracket, citizens of the District of Columbia, close bracket, residing in one of the states of the Union are classified as property and franchises of the federal government as an individual entity. Hendricks versus Maryland, quote, a U.S. citizen upon leaving the District of Columbia becomes involved in interstate commerce as a what? Resident and does not have the common law right to travel of a citizen of one of the several states, end quote. Your receipt of mail through the postal service rather than post through a post office with a zip code is one of the requirements for the IRS to have jurisdiction to send you notices. The government cannot bill a union state citizen as he or she is not within the purview of the municipal codes, the municipal laws of the District of Columbia. In fact, the Internal Revenue Service has adopted the zip code and those areas as Internal Revenue Districts. Reference the Federal Register, Volume 51, Number 53, Wednesday, March 19, 1986. You must remember that the Postal Service is a private corporation coming into existence in 1970 by way of the Postal Reorganization Act, which is a quasi-governmental agency. In point in fact, it's not a government agency at all any more than the IRS is. It is no longer a full government agency as the United States Post Office came into existence in 1775, pre-existing the origins of our nation in 1776. You know, it's kind of like the Federal Reserve, the Internal Revenue Service, and the United States Marshal Service. They are all outside the restrictions of the federal constitution as private corporations. They are all powerful in their respective areas of responsibility to enforce collection of the federal debt. So, if you are using a zip code, you are in effect saying openly and notoriously that you do not live in one of the states which are united by and under the Constitution. But instead, you are a resident in the state of Florida, the state of Georgia, the area of a District of Columbia. It's a federal district. And there are some so-called patriot groups that I consider more to be patriots for profit. They advocate the use of Title 42 suits, which are, in fact, for federal citizens only. And they send mail to you with a zip code and then ask you to do such things that actually place you within the municipal jurisdiction of the District of Columbia. Now, that doesn't mean you can't file a criminal complaint in the Seventh Amendment court system. After all, deprivation of rights under color of law, end quote, is an American common law action as well. Remember, these individuals may be agents of the government, or even worse, are advocating a one-world government by the use of the Social Security number and the zip code, so you must be aware of the movement towards a one-world government through annihilation or elimination of union state citizens by use of the so-called 14th Amendment and its related laws. The movement can be halted by the efforts of everyone to return to the status of union state citizens. By becoming a union state citizen and not a citizen of the United States, you can get the federal government off your back and out of your billfold and prayerfully return Americans to the vision of our founding fathers, to the republic for which it stands. I myself want the original Constitution for the United States of America always to apply to me, as applied against the federal government and the union states restored to their original status as republics. So all you have to do is study, determine your status, whether you are a slave A second-class citizen, commonly referred to as a federal citizen or a United States citizen, or are you actually and truly a Union State citizen of your state? You, after all, must decide who you are. So, with that having been said, let me turn this call now over to PJ, and I bet he's going to prattle on a bit about how the zip code affects so many things. PJ, you there? Okay.
Can you hear me good? Michael? Are you there? Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3. Let me check my phone to see if somebody hung me up. I don't think they did, but it looks like I'm still connected with my phone, but I can't hear anything, Michael. I don't know if anybody's hearing me. I'm going to hang up and...
PJ, can you hear me now?
Can you hear me now? I can hear you.
Okay, good. Everybody can hear you. Go ahead and I've turned the call over to you.
Okay. Okay, good. Yeah, it's very interesting. I used to kind of have a lot of reservations about the zip code and the address issue, but a friend of mine, his name was Ed Schell. He beat the IRS about 50 to 60 times. He graduated from law school in Michigan, and I think the government ended up killing him. He was a pretty healthy guy, and they just found him dead one day. Don't know for sure, but it just don't look quite right. But anyway, he showed us a case one time where the guy was challenging territorial jurisdictions, and I can't remember if it was on appeal or what. And then they brought forward part of the transcript where the prosecution read off the his address, and they said that he didn't object to the address, and that's what they based their territorial jurisdiction on. And I think he specifically said he didn't object to the zip code. So I believe that is, and since then I've coached people to be very careful about the identifying location that you give into a court record, because if you give the city, county, or state, or of course the United States address on the record or landmass of any of those identifying entities, because the word county in the statutes at large means a government-owned land, the city is chartered by the state under statehood, which only has jurisdiction in land that is of the United States. That's where their charter, that's where all their fishing license extend to. If you get a fishing license from the United States government, it has force and effect of law in land in the areas that they have land jurisdiction. Same way with city charters. Same way with county. Of course, same way with state. And when they say state, they're referring to federal state. They actually call it a state in a state. So you have the Nebraska is considered a state, and then in that state they have something called State of Nebraska. The state of Nebraska is identified as a federal zone. It's about 1.4% of Nebraska land. It's completely deceptive, and you wouldn't think anything of it until you start challenging it in court, and they'll fight you tooth and nail to get it on the record and keep it on the record and for evidence of completing the court. A friend of mine was in traffic court, and they put on the case of chief, I think they call it. And anyway, they forgot to mention the location of the event. And the attorney for the rich guy just stood up and said, Your Honor, I ask you to dismiss the case because they did not identify the location of the stop in their when they presented their case in chief. The judge dismissed the case immediately. So territorial jurisdiction is absolutely crucial. Nevada is 84% government land. And when I say government land, I'm referring to land that is titled under the name that it must be constitutionally. The Articles of Confederation said the Union must identify its land under one name, the United States of America. And my research, when I find absolutely owned federal land, it's always under that name, the United States of America. If you find it under other names, it's only a corporation. Some land is called state Nebraska. I found land called Nebraska state land, and it ended up just being a corporation. They just pick whatever they want. And I think I've even found some land called United States of America. They left the word the off, and it was a corporation. So a lot of that is likely very, very deceptive. An individual was getting a bunch of tickets on a body of water, and he was complaining, and a friend of mine helped him out, asked him to go down and find out who owns the lake, and he came back and he said that the federal government owned the boat ramp and nothing else. And that's what they were given their pretense of the authority to be able to write tickets at the boat ramp. Or maybe, I don't know if they wrote some of them on the lake or if they wrote all of them on the boat ramp. I think they always caught the people, told them to come in to the boat ramp, and then they wrote the tickets there for not having a whistle or a life jacket or boat registration or things like that. And found out later that they only own a little 100 by 100 area where the boat ramp is. It's completely deceptive. I always thought it was zoning improvement project. And Michael says it's zoning improvement. What did he say? Zoning improvement, something else.
Zone improvement plan.
Plan, yeah. I imagine he's more correct than I am. But in federal court, they take it very seriously of getting the county and the state and the zip code on the record. Every time I'm in a federal situation, I see them carefully do that. Because the federal judges coach the prosecutors to make sure they get it on there to complete the court. And if they don't get it on there, you can have the case thrown out. And if they do get it on there and it's fraudulent, you can actually challenge it post-judgment because it's a subject matter jurisdictional issue. Land jurisdiction is a part of declaring the law. Declaring the law is called subject matter jurisdiction challenge. And you can challenge that at any time. You have to, if you're going to challenge it post-judgment, you're best going in there with a certified document to produce strong evidence that the land area was not of the United States, and the opposing party will have to produce evidence to counter your evidence. If you bring in actually certified copies of plat maps and land patents and land grants, things like that. I work with people that bring in land patents and land grants to prove, and city charters and things like that to prove either jurisdiction or lack of jurisdiction. One thing I'm learning recently is that when cities get started, let's just say you got the city of, I was raised around Omaha, Nebraska. That's why I talk about Nebraska a lot. But when the city of Omaha was chartered way, way back, it had so many sections of land to go with it. And, of course, the city grows after that. Now, I'm trying to figure out if their jurisdiction grows as the city grows, because they annex property. They claim to be able to have the authority to annex property. Now, I believe that the only land that they can annex is the land that they own. I don't think they can annex private property. Of course, they do it all the time. But I think if you really pushed it in court, the only land that they have authority to annex administratively, which is statutorily, is land that is of the United States. Now, all the land that they annex under color of law is probably not taxable. It's probably not subject to the municipality. It's probably not subject to United States courts, and it is subject to American common law. So I just don't know. I've had a lot of property taken away from me over the years. I had 50 rental units, 28 houses, and battled them for many, many years, and they would never produce evidence of factual jurisdiction. They just wouldn't do it, and I just knew something stunk, and I'm putting together a program to challenge that now, even though it's years later. And over a 20-year period, they tore down probably 14 houses of mine, and it's very financially damaging. Several of those homes are, many of them were $50,000 homes, and the rest of them were $150,000 homes. So, terrible financial loss. And they just wouldn't let up. I refused to sell them, and I just hung in there and let them tear them down. And I figured I was going to come back into court to prevail later on. And I hope I'm correct. But that's what we're investigating now. If they had authority to administratively take property by applying municipal codes and demolition orders and so forth from the planning departments of the various cities, it'll be quite interesting. I'm kind of scared of the outcome because I had my hopes that they didn't have jurisdiction, but some of the property that I had was within the original sections of land of the original city, and actually it looks like most of it was that way thus far, so I might not be able to prevail on those, but then some of them are on the outside of that area. Maybe I can prevail on them. We'll see. I wish I would have known this many, many years ago. I would have challenged it differently and maybe save myself a couple $1 million. But anyway, that's what one of the things we learn as we go along. Luckily, one person can learn the lesson the hard way, and then they can convey the information to the rest of the people so they don't repeat the same problem. But it's very interesting to learn all this because property taxes are they come under the state statute laws, and then they claim that each county has the right to tax land that is within the state, and we don't have any problem with that. Now they got to prove if your property is within the state. Now the weird thing about my cases is that I would challenge territorial jurisdiction, and they wouldn't produce any evidence. They just wouldn't. I could get no findings of facts and conclusions of law from the judges, and they just left me hanging out in limbo. And I think that's just wrong. I think they're liable for damages, even if they do have jurisdiction. They still need to explain their jurisdiction. Even when they have jurisdiction, they have to explain their jurisdiction. And you know, what else are they going to explain? Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. In the absence of a prosecutor evidencing the things that you want to evidence in the record, why can't you enter the evidence in the record? For instance, here, if you were in Florida, and this is where your land is that you purchased and paid for, whatever, why can't you introduce into the record when Florida entered the union? And say,
you can't.
Florida entered the union, here's a certified cop. I'm sorry?
Yeah, you can do that. And actually, the people that we're working with, that Michael and I are working with, is actually teaching me how to bring that evidence forward by various things like that, including land grants and land patents. Because if the state has a interest in the land, it's very well taxable. If they don't have a provable interest in the land, an ownership interest in the land, then it's not taxable. So, I don't know how many, it's all kinds of situations. Every area, every purchase of land by the United States is a little bit different. You know, the Louisiana purchase is different than, the land that was purchased out in California or acquired by military force or conveyed through land grants by royalty from England, a lot of different pieces of land were handled differently. Does that make sense, Michael, to you?
Yeah. The thing that I find interesting, I noticed this today. Actually, I was in a park earlier today, and as you come into the park, there were three standards in the air. The center standard was the flag of the United States, and it was higher than anything else. On one side was the state of Florida, lower, and to the other side was the city flag to this park. And I'm sitting there looking at it, and I said, well, this is saying that the United States, which I know is Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, is sovereign to this land, and that Florida is subordinate to the United States. Yet, when is the created ever equal to its creator? Florida, a state, was one of the several states. Well, they came into it, but the 13 original states created the federal government. We, the people, created our respective states, and our respective states, through our instructions, created the federal government. So why wasn't the state flag, Florida state flag, in the center and higher position as the creator by inheritance, if you would, by being progeny to the 13 original states? Why wasn't the Florida state flag center and high over and above the United States flag that's there to serve?
Because the Florida state flag that they're flying is state of Florida, and it's a subdivision of the United States. It's not
correct.
Let's just call it Florida State, just for simple. Florida State would be the people. Or
right.
I think the accurate way to say it is, in 1913, I often bring this up because I went and looked it up myself. In 1913, prior to 1913, the laws that were created in Nebraska were, be it enacted by we the people of Nebraska. After 1913, it was being enacted by the state of Nebraska. What's the change? What happened in 1913? Michael's probably got a lot better answer for that than I do, but I think that they took the money out of circulation and they established this corporation and operating on fiat money, and it's an entity that slipped in there and started doing business and didn't tell anybody. The truth, there was no full disclosure, and it pushed out in a degree, it appeared to push out the jurisdiction of we the people of Nebraska, which isn't true because you can't push out the sovereign. So what we're doing with property tax challenges is we go in and say, is that piece of land of we the people of Nebraska or is it of the state of Nebraska? Because one is taxable by law and the other one can only be taxable by consent, contractually. So, Michael, is there any questions out there? Do you want to put your flyer out?
Well, first, Ronald has been very patient. In fact, he started being patient before the call started, actually. We'll get to Ronald in 1 second. He'll be first. Instructions, ladies and gentlemen, press star 2 on your keypad to raise your hand. Press star 2 to raise your hand, and I will see it on a board that I'm looking at. I will unmute your phone and give you the opportunity to speak directly with PJ with your comment or your question. For those of you on Freedoms Radio, you'll see a rectangle framed laying on its side. It's empty. Left-click inside of it. Type away your comment or your question. On the outside of that, you'll see a place to put your contact information. Just hit submit, and then it will appear on my end, and I'll be happy to give voice to your comment or your question. So let's start with Ronald here. Ronald, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
I hear you very well, sir.
Okay, well, I'm calling from Michigan, and today I set up a 508 charity trust, religious trust, and I tried to go to Chase Bank today and open up an account, and they wanted me to incorporate it here in the state of Michigan. Now, how can I get around that?
Okay. That's a call for Bernie on Saturday, and also, if you want to go ahead, just give me a call. You have my direct number?
No, I don't. Hold on. Let me get a pencil.
I'm not going to give you my direct number on the open call. I've got your number here. Yeah, I got your number, Ronald. And I'm going
to
call you when the call is over. Can you hold on for that for a little bit?
Right. Okay.
All right. I got that up.
And you do not have to incorporate.
No, you do not. Furthermore, the answer that they gave you, Ronald, the answer that they gave you is because they perceive at this point they're dealing with a statutory trust. This is non-statutory. This is not even in their part of the law. This is ecclesiastical law. It's not admiralty law or chancery or anything else. This is admiralty.
My question is, how can I get around that? Because that's one of the requirements at Chase Bank.
Yeah, we're gonna work
with you
on
that.
All right. Okay.
I'll call you tonight. Go ahead.
All right.
PJ.
All right.
Yeah, they come after you with. You know, they believe you have to fill out these forms to do this and this and this. We have forms to. That we submit that acceptable to them. See, one thing they're doing is they give you forms and you fill them out. You put the word, you fill in the county and the state, and that you just told them false evidence, probably, that this church ministry was going to be operating in land of the United States. So if you're going to do that, you're going to probably be under their guide, their requirements.
Yeah.
But if you fill it out properly, independent of the land of the United States, which would be private property, then they don't have any nexus for governance or taxation or anything like that. So, okay, next question.
Thank
right,
you,
Ron. As soon as this call is over with tonight, I will be calling you back directly. Again, press star 2 on your keypad. We don't have a lot of people raising their hands here. We need to either that or we're going to have an early call tonight. Yeah. Greg, good to see you. How's it going?
Everything's going great. I got in a little late on the call, and I just wanted to know, have you all went over the Union State Citizen as far as the questions that you may be asked? Have y'all
well, the call, it? The call tonight's call is jurisdiction, and it's to hammer again harder the difference between one jurisdiction and the other. United States, as a legal defined word or two words, has three definitions. Of the three definitions, two of them have to do with either the political status of land or people. And so we hammer into that on the Tuesday night call. Your question actually is for the Monday night call and its application. Furthermore, why don't you call me tomorrow, and it needs to be after 12 o'clock Eastern because I'm going to have you have a direct conference call with GW. And he's 3 hours behind us. So noon, call me around noon tomorrow, and we'll hook you up with him for a direct consult.
Okay. Problem. Thank you so much.
Sure. My pleasure. Anyone else, press star 2 on your keypad, or otherwise we're going to have a real quiet night tonight. Shouldn't do that. Brent, welcome to the call, Brent.
Good evening. I'm actually
good evening to you.
Sitting out here looking at the beach in Waikiki right now. But
Waikiki?
Yeah. This whole
4 in the afternoon?
Yep.
Enjoy.
Yeah. Anyways, normally I miss these calls because I'm working, but today I was able to get on. This whole idea that they have so many aspects, the zip code and, you know, the name of the place where you live in the town or the county or the state. How do you get around? I mean, it's just like they've got so many aspects of this thing wrapped up. How do you effectively really get out of that identification with the United States Corporation?
It's called burden of proof. You want to talk about the burden of proof?
Say that again.
Brent was asking about all these tripwires that they have in place, you know, city, county, zip, state, whatever. And the hammer that you love to pick up regarding that is that you have a quote that you always say in the courtroom.
You keep the burden of proof on them. The if they make a claim that you're subject to their written law, and they ask you, like for example, they ask you, is your business in Douglas County? You just simply say, under oath, you say, I have no evidence that I've ever elected to do any business in Douglas County. So it shifts the burden of proof to them. If you say, no, I have no business in Douglas County, then they could ask you, do you have any evidence to prove that? And if you say, yes, you have business in Douglas County, then they can administratively govern you. So you want to stay somewhat neutral, but keep the burden of proof upon them by simply stating to everything they ask, you pretty much repeat what they said, and you say, like they ask you, did you have any business in the city of Omaha? You just respond you answer the question by saying, I have no evidence in my possession that I've ever elected to have any business in the city of Omaha. And I've done this in court, and the judge will bark at me and say, that's a yes or no question. I'll say I they force you to say yes or no. So I'll say because I have no evidence I'll have to say no because I have no evidence in my possession that I'm ever elected to do any business in this city of Omaha. But the key is to keep the burden of proof on them, because if you keep the burden of proof on them, they have to put somebody in the witness stand. They can't just have the attorney if you're challenging it under common law, the attorney cannot testify, cannot produce evidence. He has to produce that evidence with a common fact witness, and that's where your leverage is. For example, with IRS, the most important thing you can do in an IRS case is get the witness on the witness chair that claims that you have a requirement to file, or you have a requirement to withhold, or you have a requirement to pay money due and owing to the United States. You get that guy in the witness chair and you ask him. You say, you know, you've had 30 days to bring to answer this question. What'd you bring us? And that's how we beat the IRS. Every time I've seen an individual follow our guidelines strictly, we've won every single case with the IRS. So does that help explain it to you? Now, Michael's working on a process.
Real quick.
Yeah, go ahead, Michael.
Let me add that real quick. Your Honor, U.S. Code, Title I, Chapter 1, Section 2 states the word county includes a parish or any other equivalent subdivision of a state or territory of the United States. Is that what you're in reference to when you talk about Broward County or Volusia County, whatever county you want to talk about? Are you trying to get me to confess to being in a territory of the United States when you know damn right well that Florida came into the Union and is a progeny through law with the original 13 states? Is that what you're trying to do?
Yeah, you got to be very careful. You probably don't want to do this stuff verbally. You want to do it in written form so you don't make any mistakes on your challenges. But if you do screw up in court, immediately you file a document to correct the record. And you put it in an affidavit form. And then that affidavit prevails. Now the other side has to produce evidence to conflict with the statements of your affidavit, and they're probably not going to have it. If that land is of the United States, all they have to do is bring in evidence of an ownership interest. They can own interest in the water rights, the air rights, the flyover rights, the oil rights, the gas rights, you know, a lot of things. They might have a right to pass through the land. There's all kinds of stipulations.
One thing else, too, that you can do, and TJ advocates this, is that you put into the record immediately there will be no oral arguments, and that any questions that they ask you, you just say to them, look, I'm not trained in the law. You have words that mean one thing in the Vulgate, in the vulgar, in the common language, and mean something totally else in legal terms. You know, like the word resident, you know, everybody uses that to mean that's where you live. It's just a common thing. But in a courtroom, in a legal situation, resident means that you have a domicile in Washington, D.C. Your Honor, I've never been to Washington, D.C. So how can I have a domicile there? And that's what the legal definition is. You know that. So why is this thing full of trickery? So if
we
have a question,
we recently submitted a brief to a federal judge, and after the federal judge read it, that person decided to seek to resign from the job that person had for, I think, 26 years or something, right, in a long, long time. And because the judge realized that been putting people in jail for all those years under a false understanding of jurisdiction, the application of Title 26.
They don't teach this in law school, Brent. You have to
teach
them.
So...
But anyway, you don't have to prove it. We can help you keep the burden of proof on them. And if you do it right away, when they start messing with you, they usually leave you alone immediately because they don't want to stir up any of those. They don't want to open a can of worms that they can't collect later on. Does that help answer your question? You got a little bit more?
Yeah, I got a little bit more. So you're talking about once you get into court, are there things that you can do that prevent that from ever happening? You know,
yeah.
So you go through and correct your status, so you correct your status, you still have a Social Security number, and that still ties you. You still have a zip code. You still live in a, you know, your address is still, you get mail through the post office.
No, you don't. That's all prima facie evidence. That's not fact evidence. You can put the proper documents in.
Brent.
Go ahead.
Yes, sir, Michael.
You and I are in and subject to two governments. But the thing is, the governments, each of them, have to defend and protect your rights. And you are responsible for crimes that you may commit in either government. But with correcting your status, you have the shield of the Bill of Rights and all the other founding documents as an estoppel against them moving against you for crimes that would have otherwise been adjudicated, you would have been charged with if you were a federal citizen. So, you know, what is your Social Security number? I have no evidence that I have a Social Security number. The truth is, if you find the actual wording, it will say that the Social Security number belongs to the Social Security Administration. It's their number.
Okay.
The driver's license that you have belongs to the state that you got the driver's license. It doesn't belong to you. So you can honestly sit there and say, I don't have a Social Security number.
Okay? Yeah, it's the use of it that can get you in trouble. It's not having it. It's the use of it. Don't worry about having one. It's the use of it. So, like a marriage license. You know, very few people in America have a marriage license because they were not living on government land when they went and asked the courthouse to give them a marriage license. They weren't eligible or qualified for a state marriage license. It was given to them fraudulently. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, there's a court case I wanted to bring up for Brent. Go ahead, Brent.
Well, today I was looking at a crowdfunding investment with a 3D printing company that's head and shoulders above everything else. And in there, you have to check a box that says U.S. citizen or non-U.S. citizen. So I checked the non-U.S. citizen box, and oh my gosh, what a can of worms that opened up.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
You have to jump through a whole bunch of hoops in order to even proceed. So I just stopped the process.
Well, remember again, there are three definitions for U.S. citizen, and you can sit there and say, yeah, I'm a U.S. citizen. But if it comes to litigation, if it comes to any question, you can say, I'm a U.S. citizen. Look at Black's Law, Sixth Edition, Third Definition. That's me. That's talking about a citizen of one of the several states of the Union.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's two court cases. There's two. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
But anyway, there's usually a little bit of room on those documents. You could put it in a little disclaimer, explain it to them.
Yeah, I don't want to.
It's not a big deal.
Didn't mean to overtalk you, Brent. What was your saying? What were you saying?
No, I was done. That's all.
All right. Well, there's two court cases I want to share with you. More. Go ahead.
Okay. Go ahead. Go ahead. No, go ahead.
All right. Moore versus Valentine. This is 1852. This is prior to the Civil War. It says, quote, every citizen of the United States is also a citizen of a state or territory. He may be said to owe allegiance to two sovereigns and may be liable to punishment for an infraction of the laws of either. The other one is Houston versus Moore, 1820. Every citizen of a state owes a double allegiance. He enjoys the protection and participates in the government of both the state and the United States. So, What this is saying is, if your behavior happened upon land of the United States versus that same behavior on the land of a state, the state, it would depend then upon which law applied to you. And the second part is the same as the first part. If you're a citizen of a state, then you have rights and immunities that are articulated in the Bill of Rights and all the other founding documents. But if you're a citizen of the United States, by default, without clarifying those two definitions, you're a federal citizen with no rights from the Creator. You just have privileges extended to you by the Congress. So these two right here show the double allegiance, and it shows the protections that you have within these court cases.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. I hope I've helped. I hope PJ helped. All right, next is Kent, followed by Jennifer, and followed by my favorite guy, Investigator Alan. Or not, well, he likes to be called Ringo, Johnny Ringo. Go ahead, Kent.
Oh, good evening, gentlemen. PJ, I want to ask you a question regarding rental properties, because anybody that's been in that enterprise or business or endeavor knows that there's many problems across the board, including property taxes, tax certificates, violations, installation of utility lines, business licenses that attach to the property, insurance company issues, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and even going on to condemnation, mortgage issues. Do you think that all of these issues really have a special, something special attached to them, that they have to be fought on specifics, for example, when you talk about property taxes? Or do you think that we're possibly missing something, or we have missed something to date where we've ended up doing it that way, when all of these aforementioned issues really relate to one thing related to jurisdiction? And then the second part of my question is, do you think that based upon who we rent these properties to, be they residential, industrial, or commercial, has any bearing on the outcome of these issues and how we're affected by them being able to dictate to us what we can do with these properties?
If the federal government supplies money for rent to you, I don't think they can dictate that much, but they can just withdraw their funding. Now, I do know they dictate a lot, but I don't think they're supposed to do that. They're supposed to just withdraw their funding, or threaten to withdraw their funding if you don't fly the flag properly. They can withdraw the funding for that building. It's their choice to do that.
Could you clarify something on that? When you say withdraw the funding, are you talking about funding that may come through the occupant of that building and flow through to the owner of the building or the party renting it to them? Or are you talking about some direct kind of payment to the owner of the property?
Yeah, I'm talking about a payment from the federal. It's a check that's actually issued by the federal government or the state. Directly from, not from the tenant at all. But if the tenant was a corporation giving you money, that's not a nexus with the United States. But unless you adopted his jurisdiction contractually. Now, as far as the landlord laws and so forth, taxation on the rental property, if the land is of the United States, then it is subject to the state. That is a subdivision of the United States. So I've been using Nebraska a lot. So state of Nebraska is a subdivision of the United States. Okay, it's a subdivision. It is of the United States. It's just subdivided out. It's kind of like a building. You got some different rooms in there, and each one's subdivided for different purposes, but it's all one building. This is all the United States land is United States land, which is about 25% of America. Now, if I believe that if a city is established on land that is not of the United States, I think it's a fraudulent jurisdiction across the board. Because I don't think all these cities in America is on land that is of the United States. I think it's fraudulent because Michael and I have examined a great many documents and maps and so forth, and it just says that 24% of America is of the United States. And when you look at those maps, you don't see a big area of New York City in the color of land that is of the United States. It doesn't do that. You might have a couple little squares in there where a federal courthouse is or IRS building is, but it's not turn the entire New York area red to designate a federal zone. And I think Michael would agree with me that that's his experience too. So I think it's fraudulent. Now, the only other thing they have going is the cities have authority to operate as an entity. Okay, so the city of Omaha will operate under the laws of the United States. Okay, they have that permission to do that, but how in the world can they get land jurisdiction in land that is not of the United States? They can't just venture out there and, okay, we're going to take these few sections of land here, and we're going to start claiming that as the city of Omaha. And we're going to operate there where the subdivision of the state of Nebraska, which is a subdivision of the United States, is going to operate. I don't think they can do that. I think it's just acting under color of law. You just can't gobble up all of Nebraska turned into the city of Omaha. How in the world could all of Nebraska turn into a federal zone? No, no, no. The sovereigns don't allow that. Does that make sense to you too, Michael? The reasoning of that?
Yeah. You've got a map that I've shared with everyone over multiple times, federal land map, and it shows where the federal lands are and where they're not.
Yeah, we don't see on that map big area of New York just completely all red in color, designating it to be a federal zone. That's not my experience when I look at those maps. But that's something we'll be learning in the future. We've talked to federal judges about this. We've had five federal judges in a room talking to them, and they agreed that they didn't understand jurisdiction. And the more I talked about jurisdiction, the more they realize that they don't understand, even the ones that thought they understood. They have to prove that. See, land jurisdiction is easily proven because it's documented. Okay, it's the government has to document the land that they own. So bring forth the document. Once they bring forth the document, you can examine it closely to make sure that it was all done by law, and that no color of law participated in getting that document to the state that it's in. And the Constitution requires states to do certain things, which means the sovereignty of the people, to do certain things to allow this statehood to expand in their land. Because the Constitution says that the United States is forts, arsenals, and docks, and other needful buildings, which is military. It's a description of military. So how in the world did they get a description of military to become the city of New York or the city of Omaha, Nebraska? I think it's all bluff myself. The more I learn about this, the more I realize I don't know what I don't have it down either. In a lot of these technical issues. Is that your experience too, Michael?
so
So these issues that I'm raising on all these different subjects that apply to, you know, generally to rental properties, what you're really saying is that it comes down to a jurisdiction issue, and all of these issues fall under that in one form or another. And issues that we've been fighting one by one for a long time, really there's a bigger picture here as to whether it's property taxes or whether it's missing light bulbs or missing stair railings. The bigger issue
right.
is whether they have any jurisdiction, whether this is part of U.S. land to begin with.
That's right. And he who asserts authority must prove authority. Another way to say that is he who asserts jurisdiction must prove, must evidence that, must support that assertion. You don't have to do it. They have to do it. Now, my experience when the Omaha, City of Omaha Planning Department would come after me on a property, and they've done it for 30 years, never have they ever brought in evidence to prove land jurisdiction. Not one time. They would bring in a plat map that says, or identification of a piece of land that says, Lot 7, Block 4, subdivided in the City of Omaha. Okay, so it sounds like it's in the City of Omaha, but the City of Omaha is a charter of the, is a subdivision of the state and a subdivision of the United States. So how in the world did that become a federal zone? If it's a subdivision, it's a federal zone. I don't think there's any way around it, land jurisdiction-wise. Am I thinking of this right, Michael? Do you believe that's true?
What is true is the evidence that they have to place upon the record of the land jurisdiction and of the personam jurisdiction. It's territorial jurisdiction and personam jurisdiction.
Yep. The jurisdictions they have to produce is there's four legs to jurisdiction. They always have jurisdiction to see if they have jurisdiction. Okay, you cannot deny them of that. The next one is personal jurisdiction. Okay, do these laws apply to you as a person? And then the next level of jurisdiction is territorial jurisdiction. Okay, which is land jurisdiction. Does the law offer have force and effect in a given area of land, which is a three-dimensional space? And then you've got jurisdiction as the described activity, which is often called subject matter jurisdiction. The statute has to be unambiguous as to regulated an activity. And there's another jurisdiction. Maybe that's all of them. Okay, I might think of another one. But sometimes they branch out in different areas. It gets a little complex sometimes. But that's the main thing: personal jurisdiction, the activity, the land jurisdiction, and then of course I said the courts always have jurisdiction to see if they have jurisdiction. You can't deprive them of that.
Kent, I just sent the land jurisdiction map to PD Mann, and I also sent it to Layman Lynn. So,
okay.
Whichever of those two, one of those two, you have it in your inbox right now.
Okay, thank you very
I'll
much.
Tell you a I'll tell you a little story on land jurisdiction. I was in federal court, and I was a little naive, and I took on an attorney because I thought it would help in my case, the first time I've been in federal court and facing 60 years of jail. And so I wrote up a jurisdictional challenge, a territorial jurisdictional challenge. I wrote it up by hand because I was in jail. I did a very good job of writing it up, very precise. And I wanted to get that on the record. And my attorney that the state paid for, or the federal government paid for, they paid him $12,000 to basically do nothing for me except block my arguments. He said he would not file that document. So he stood up during court and says, PJ wants to file this document into the record, and I want the court to know that I have nothing to do with this. I do not agree with his challenge, but he is basically forcing me to notice the court of this. And then the judge goes, okay, we'll receive the documents. And like a stupid idiot, I didn't make them put an evidence number on it and receive it into evidence. And those documents disappeared from the record, and the record, the oral record disappeared, never showed up in the transcript. Now, I believe if they scrubbed it from the record physically and orally, they have a great fear of that document. That tells me a lot. Why would they commit a felony to get that out of there? So I think it's extremely powerful challenge in almost every case. Okay, go ahead. Next.
Hi. On that second part of the question that I asked, I want to separate that from your response regarding the such things as Section 8 housing or direct payments, et cetera, or even indirect payments. I was asking, when you're renting to somebody who's likely to be a U.S. citizen, assuming you're not renting to a corporation or an LLC or whatever, likely to be a U.S. citizen, do you think that that has any effect on them being able to gain some kind of jurisdiction over that property because you're now renting to someone presumed to be a U.S. citizen and most likely collecting Federal Reserve notes?
No. No, it doesn't. That person has to come to your parity, to your level. You do not have to stoop to their level. They're coming to you for business. And they have to, it's man-to-man. Common law, because that's the jurisdiction that you're presenting. You're we can help you write up documents for that in the leases and stuff. The only problem is when you start going into common law, and you know, like in Mexico, state of Mexico, nation of Mexico, you know how they evict their tenants. The landlord says, get out. You got, I'll give you 24 hours to get out or 2 days to get out. And if they don't get out, a bunch of men show up and help them move out. Now, after they move out, they can go to court. They have due process and they could sue the landlord for evicting them for without cause. But he doesn't have to go to court for 30 days or 20 days or 6 months to get you out. He gets you out in 2 days. And then you go to court for damages if somebody has been wronged. That's common. That's pure common law. That's the way it should work in America. That's the way you can write your contract with your tenants. And now I didn't learn. I had all those tenants, 50 tenants at one time. I didn't know about this, and I was struggling in those statutory courts. They destroyed me. They destroyed my business pretty much. They just made it impossible to do business. The tenants could break windows in my house and destroy the house, and I'd go to court, and the judge says, "Well, you shouldn't be allowed to collect rent on a house that has broken windows." And I said, "Judge, they are the ones breaking the windows every day. Are you insane? Are you insane? I cannot evict them. I cannot require payment for rent because of the broken windows when they are the ones breaking the windows inside the house. This is not outside the house. This is inside the house." Oh, my gosh. These are crazy, crazy U.S.
All right,
judges.
We have one more. We have one more guest for questions.
I want to make one more comment. I want to make one more comment. Thank you, PJ, for your response, and thank you for that parody response. I want to think about that a little more. I want to just make a general comment, Michael, about Chase Bank, whom we have some experience with here. And Chase Bank has a very, very complicated book that most people within the bank don't know how to read when it comes to opening certain types of accounts and accomplishing certain things, which you're probably aware of already. but there's a possibly a more treacherous thing with Chase Bank, and that is the problems that can ensue if somebody passes away and they want to question how something is going to be transferred. So it would be, in my opinion, based on my experience, defective just to look at going into and opening the account. One should look further as to what happens if there has to be a change once the account is there, because you can run into actually nightmares with them. Not saying they couldn't happen with another bank.
Yeah. Can you give me a call tomorrow sometime in the afternoon, and I'll conference you in with Judge Bernie and with Raven, and we can explore that further.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Sounds interesting,
Jennifer,
though.
Thank you for your patience, Miss Jennifer. I'd let you know I saw the email. I've already forwarded that your second request to PJ and John for them to respond to. Just to let you know.
Thanks. Am I
Jennifer?
Can you hear me? Oh.
Yeah.
Yes, I can.
Okay. Thanks. Why? I just kind of like going back to the person before the last person. You know, why should we have to learn all of their crap just because they want to trick us into things? Like, why do I have to write on my address, which half the time I can't online, that, you know, that extra line, a post location, you know, not within the United States or whatever the other two things are? Why should we have to write that anywhere? Why can't we just tell them that's what it means later on if they ever try to use our address as hopping into their jurisdiction?
Well, they that really doesn't have a tremendous effect against you unless you're sworn in a court proceeding. You're actually sworn in, or it's being offered as evidence. That's where it really is before the court. So if you say you're a United States citizen 1,000 times during the month, but you don't say it while you're sworn in, and you object when they refer to you as a U.S. citizen in the courtroom on the record, all those 999 times that you did it before that month means nothing.
Even if it's a written
address.
On a government document. Okay.
Yes, because they're going to have to establish it on the record, and you always have the right to correct the record. Now, if you're writing on the letter that it's not a federal zone and it is a federal zone, see, it works both ways. So both parties have the right to correct the record to be factually true. And they must correct the record to be factually true. If they don't, it's a felony.
Mm-hmm. Anytime
so you're you're always covered. You're always covered. The good thing about putting this stuff on some of your material that you can put on is it scares them away, because I've done this since the year of 2000, and they've pretty much left me alone, IRS. But anyway, go ahead.
I've searched online for federal zones in New York State, and nothing ever comes up. It's all about the voting zones and districts that doesn't ever bring up a map of the federally owned land in New York. And anyway, one more thing. So I feel a little concerned about whether my house is going to be foreclosed on then. If they don't produce any evidence and say too bad and they just foreclose on you.
If you write a check and you pay under protest, that gives you the window and the opportunity to come right in and sue them as the plaintiff. So you can protect your interest on one side and then take them to court to have that funds, those funds returned. John is aware of what's going on, and I need to have you conference with PJ and John soon, very soon.
And you can make strict stipulations for them to strongly consider before they cash that check. If they don't have factual evidence that they have right to collect. Now there's federal guidelines that you're supposed to follow. The Congress has laid it out. You have to do certain things before you can have the right to collect on a secondary, as a secondary or third member party. The original lender doesn't have to go through congressional steps, but the people after them, which becomes a debt collector, they have to follow congressional guidelines. And if they don't, it's a crime.
Well, there's no lender with this.
No, this is.
Well, they're foreclosing. But somebody has to make a claim. Somebody has to make a claim that you owe property taxes, and that person is liable in his personal commercial liability. There's no way around it. He has a duty to investigate if there's fact evidence that you're within the taxing jurisdiction and they have taxing authority over that land before he opens his mouth or before he makes a public record. It's a felony for him to make a public record that land is taxable without him first evidencing that it's taxable. It's a felony.
Well,
so John can put notices together that will accompany your check, and these guys are going to look at this like, don't cash that check. I don't want to go to jail. I believe that's one way to look at it, because we've done this before. I've worked with people that have done this before, and they notified us and they said, we're going to give you a release of lien. This is a mortgage issue, which is similar to property taxes. We're going to give you a release of lien or release of pay property taxes because we don't want to go to jail. They flat out said that because we didn't know this. We didn't know the federal law required this. We don't want to go to jail. I'm not going to go to jail over this. This job doesn't pay enough. So they have no authority to deceive you into a corner and make you pay, it's a crime. And we hope to get common law courts assembled to bring us bear down on this directly. Because right now the bearing down has been done by the fox watching the hen house, and it doesn't go well for the hens. So that's why we want to go into common law courts.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
One more thing about Chase Bank. I actually spoke to a manager in Texas of a Chase Bank, and he said to me that the Chase Bank doesn't like paying out trust funds to people, that they actually, if you don't have the exact proper documents that they want, they keep the money. And then they're allowed to keep it for 3 years, and then they have to turn it over to the state, and they get the money. But that's a racket.
You got that?
And then when I got my trust documents notarized in Texas from a bank manager in a Wells Fargo bank, he incorrectly signed it according to his stamp, and so that when I came to New York to get the account opened, they refused to accept this other bank manager's, same bank, but Wells Fargo, this other bank manager's signature. And so you've just got to be careful with these bloody banks.
Yeah. Yeah, we have a few banks that we're working with well, so I don't think Michael wants to air them right now. But, no. Okay, next.
Okay, I think.
All right. Thank you very much, Jennifer Sue. Johnny Ringo, did you, if you want to make some comments, just hit press star 2 real quick. Otherwise, we're going to call it an evening. I saw you had your hand up earlier and then disappeared. There you go. Welcome, Johnny Ringo.
Yeah, I've, you guys talk about state citizens. Just exactly how many types of state citizens are there?
One for each state.
Well,
I'll comment. I'll comment on that.
Okay.
I do not encourage state citizens. If anybody is trying to exercise authority over you, anybody, they have to prove it. So that's where I leave it. I'm not an advocate of using the word state at all for anything. Now, I believe it's much safer to call yourself a Nebraskan national, a Texas national, a California national. Notice we're not using the word state in there because the word state in their statutory world is defined as a possession or territory of the United States. So that's a bad word for me. I just stay away from the word state. But there's people that are a lot smarter. There's people that are a lot smarter than me that don't have trouble using the word state, but they do define it in the document. Go ahead.
Well, there are five different state citizens categories of state citizen.
You don't have to categorize. Why categorize yourself at all? You're a free man.
What are they, Johnny Ringo?
They're the American state national, the state citizen, yeah. Federal United States citizen, the territorial United States citizen, and the municipal citizens of the United States. Those are the five categories that the federal government categorizes each and every individual in this country as.
Can you email me that?
When you guys talk about state citizens, you know, there's territorial state citizens and federal state citizens and municipal citizens beyond, plus your state and American state national, and they are categorized. And each one has a definite definition of each. And when you explain to people about the citizens, you kind of mix the federal and the territorial up as one, and they're not. They're definitely different. But I was just wondering if you guys go by the categories or if it's just a general.
Well, Black's Law Dictionary, 6th edition, 5th and 4th edition, Taking it from the Bidwell decision of 1901 and the Hooven decision of 1945, give you the second definition is United States. It may designate the territory over which the sovereignty of the United States extends. So that would be federal and territorial lands. Then the third definition is it may be the collective names of the states, which are united by and under the Constitution.
Well, territorial citizens are now commonly dual citizens of the British Commonwealth and the municipal United States. If you're talking territorial. But we'll leave it at that. I was just wondering if you guys know the actual definition
of
each.
They have to prove it.
Not to be combined.
Very much like for you to... You've got my email, Johnny Ringo. Please just share that with me, will you?
Yeah. He who expresses authority must prove it.
I've got it. I don't say it because I deal mainly, all in federal criminal courts. And the reason why I was listening to your program was to see if any type of citizen would have any difference when it becomes in front of a federal court or a federal judge. And I've questioned several different federal judges about it, and they say in plain English, it don't mean a rat's ass who you are. You're going to jail if you're in front of our federal court. We don't care what type of citizen or what country you're from. So that's their statement.
If they have evidence that you reached into their jurisdiction and did something, that's true.
Well, yeah, the federal, yeah, the federal government is, they've got the jurisdiction of the United States and their territories. So. Plus,
but that's not the experience. That's not the experience I have in federal court. They bend over backwards to get evidence on the record that it occurred in one of their federal zones. The average person sitting there listening doesn't know what they're doing, but you can see it when you look for it. They'll spend hours on it at times if somebody challenges it.
Right. I was just wondering if you guys actually, because you weren't differentiating between the different types. So, but anyway,
yeah.
We'll leave it go at that.
Yeah, that's why I stay away from the word state, just to be safe. Okay, let's close her up.
Yeah. All right. I want to thank everyone for joining us this evening. Really appreciate your time and attention to this. We'll be returning next week, Monday, with GW, actually processing, showing you the process to a degree of translating from being the de facto federal citizen that you were put in by the State Department to be, and into a citizen of one of the states. A American national is the nomenclature that's used. So until then, good night, everybody, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you.